So this morning, I want to talk about beautiful feet and the theme, No Greater Love, which has been the theme of our missions month. And the really big idea is that loving God means doing what he commands. Our world outreach theme this month has been taken from Jesus' statement to his disciples in John chapter 15, verses 12 to 14. This is my commandment. Love each other in the same way I loved you. There is no greater love than to lay down one's life for one's friends. You are my friends if you do what I command. Though Jesus' 12 disciples were far from perfect, as we know, after Jesus returned to heaven, they exemplified their love for him by living holy lives and by taking the gospel farther than anyone believed possible. The next two generations of Christ followers did the same. They were friends and did what he commanded. Google identifies 1,050 commands in the New Testament that Christians should obey. And if we've been taught in disciples, we're familiar with them. If we've read through the New Testament, we're familiar with them. They're not new. But which ones are the most important? When a Pharisee asked Jesus that question, and this is in Matthew 22:36. Jesus said, the greatest commandment was, you must love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, and all your mind. That is the first and greatest commandment. A second is equally important. Love your neighbor as yourself. But his last command to his disciples was to make disciples of the nations, all of the nations. Is it possible to obey both of the two greatest commandments and not Christ's last commandment? Is it possible that to show love for him and obedience to him if we ignore it? Is it possible for us here at Westside to obey all three? Well, it depends. Church tradition holds that before the 11 of the 12 disciples were martyred, John was the only one who lived to a very old age, and that was because God wanted him to write the book of Revelation. But they brought the good news of Jesus north to what is today modern Turkey, Ukraine, and southern Russia, as far east as India and Ceylon, as far west as Spain and Portugal, and as far south as Egypt, Ethiopia, and North Africa. How they did this in so short a time is still a great mystery. The next two generations of Christians planted churches in Rome-controlled Britain, China, Tibet, South Arabia, and Eastern Europe. They did this in the context of intense persecution and without automobiles, four-lane highways, airplanes, radios, computers, televisions, cell phones, the internet, protective vaccines, antibiotics, and Elon Musk's satellites. They walked thousands of miles, rode on horses, donkeys, camels, and fragile ships smaller than today's super yachts. But a few generations later, Satan viciously counterattacked. He planted false prophets in the churches who preached heresies. He enabled the rapid and violent growth of Islam and its bloody conquests of the Middle East and Egypt, Central Asia, North Africa, Spain, and parts of Eastern Europe. On this side, the spread of Islam, on this slide, the spread of Islam is indicated in brown. That was where all the places that were taken over by armies, Islamic armies. And as you can see, Muhammad took over many of the areas of the early church had evangelized. Christians either fled those areas, died for their faith, or were enslaved. During this time, deadly plagues came that wiped out entire towns and decimated cities all across Europe and Central Asia. The plagues killed both unbelievers and Christians, but more Christians survived the plagues because of their love for each other. They cared for each other. They didn't abandon sick people on the streets and throw them out of their houses. As a matter of fact, the triumph of, in Rodney Stark's book, The Triumph of Christianity, which I would strongly recommend to you to read, Christians proved their love again and again during those plagues by ministering to their dying neighbors and strangers. bringing them into their homes to care for them, feeding them, giving them, bringing them water, washing them. It was during these centuries that Christians first established hospitals. In those times, it was impossible for Christians to love the Lord with all their heart, soul, and mind and not take the gospel to neighboring nations. This was their response to the Apostle Paul's question in Romans 10:14. How can they hear about Jesus unless someone tells them? And how will anyone go and tell them without being sent? Can we, followers of Christ at Westside Church in Reading in 2024, do what the early Christians did? Are our resources more meager? Is our membership too modest? Is the awareness of our obligation to reach the world with the gospel too vague? Here is the key question. If asked, could we bring the gospel to even one of the last 7,272 unreached people groups that have been identified and that remain? It depends. In Romans 10:15, the Apostle Paul asks, and how will anyone go and tell them without being sent? That is why the scriptures say, how beautiful are the feet of messengers who bring good news. He was quoting from Isaiah 52:7, where God said to Isaiah, how beautiful on the mountains are the feet of the messenger who brings good news. The good news of peace and salvation, the news that the God of Israel reigns. For thousands of years, God has considered beautiful the feet of his people who take his word to people in darkness. Let me share with you three examples of ordinary Christians, really ordinary Christians, who obeyed Jesus, walked on beautiful feet, and changed the world. Hudson Taylor was one of those. Historian Ruth Tucker summarized his life by saying, no other missionary in the 19th century since the Apostle Paul had a wider vision and has carried out a more systematized plan of evangelizing a broad geographical area than Hudson Taylor. The only extra education that he had other than high school was medicine, which I'm very proud of, and also the Bible. He was a very ordinary man. Not particularly handsome, kind of short, a little bit stocky, but his faith and his courage and obedience will forever be known by the Chinese as the man with the beautiful feet. He was born in England in 1832 to godly parents and gave his life to Christ at the age of 17. A few months later, he sensed God calling him to take the gospel to China. He had heard about China from a few less than 10 missionaries that had already gone and were sending back reports of this huge country with hundreds of millions of people and that was totally in the dark about what Jesus had done. In 1853, at the age of 21, he sailed from England to China. The voyage took 5 months. Once he arrived, he began studying the Chinese language and culture. It took him 4 years to learn to speak, read, and write Chinese. But as he tried to befriend the people, he soon learned that his Western clothes and hairstyle were offensive to them. Despite strong disapproval from other senior missionaries, the few ones that were there, Hudson and his other colleagues shaved their heads, grew pigtails, and dressed like the Chinese. For that, they were mocked by their colleagues, but the Chinese loved it. And some of those they were able to befriend and lead to faith. They were able to lead to faith and to disciple. But after a decade of witness and a church of maybe 50 souls, Hudson thought that he just couldn't get over the thought and the sorrow that there were 400 million Chinese going to an eternal Christless destiny. He spent hours on his knees praying and pleading with God, and finally, God challenged him to form a new agency of Christian workers that would not rely on money. They would live on faith, where they would not settle comfortably in coastal cities, but in the vast, unreached populations of inland China. They would become fluent in the language and follow Chinese customs, including dress and hairstyles. They would eat what the Chinese ate. They would live in houses as the Chinese did. and as much as possible live like the common people. God honored Hudson's faith and his obedience, and within a decade, hundreds of young English believers, many of them from the universities, joined him. His workers didn't need to be highly educated, but they did have to be men and women of great faith, trained to share their faith and be willing to live as simply as the Chinese lived. And of course, they had to learn the customs and they had to learn the language. Hudson spent 54 years serving in China, recruited more than 800 international workers with beautiful feet. And he brought the gospel to every one of China's 19 provinces. At his death in 1905, at the age of 73, the church he had founded had grown to 20,000 Chinese converts and was led by hundreds of Chinese leaders. Today, there are an estimated 54 million Christians in China, representing 4% of the population. What can we learn from Hudson Taylor that could enable someone from our church, Westside Church of Reading, to succeed in taking the gospel to an unreached people group today? First of all, Hudson Taylor lived by faith and loved God with all of his heart. Secondly, he left his home and family and moved to China, where he learned the language and culture. Third, regardless of the dangers and distances, he faithfully proclaimed the good news to the people God sent him to save. Fourth, he considered his life to be less important than the lives of the people God called him to. And fifth, until he died, he never stopped making disciples and teaching them to obey the commands of Jesus, including his last command, to take the gospel to the world. Another amazing person in mission history is Mary Mitchell Slessor. She was born in Aberdeen, Scotland in 1848. She was small, with red hair, bright blue eyes, and a timid personality. Remember that, a timid personality. She was only 10 when her father's alcoholism and subsequent unemployment forced her to work as a worker and a weaver in the textile mills to support her family. Yet even after a 12-hour schedule, she found time to study the Bible, worship God, and improve her slim education. She eventually served as a Sunday school teacher in her local church. In 1873, Mary was captivated by the flurry of reports following the death of the famous Dr. David Livingstone. Inspired by his life, she immediately applied to her church's Foreign Mission Board. 2 years later, at the age of 27 and single, she accepted the mission board's appointment to Duketown, Calabar, near the southeastern coast of present-day Nigeria. Calabar proved to be a dangerous and challenging area, especially for an attractive young woman. Mary was undaunted. Helped by seasoned missionaries, she learned all she could about the local culture of the Parsley-Reach tribe there, the Efik people, and studied their language until she was fluent. As would be the case for the rest of her life, Mary's greatest emphasis was the gospel, which she conveyed to everyone she met, resting on God's power to transform hard hearts. After a few years in Calabar, she tired of the humdrum life of the missionary community and set her sights on taking the gospel to a totally unreached tribe that was greatly feared, the unreached Okoyong people. A day's ride upriver, they were completely left alone because of their violence and their tendency to eat people. As was her custom, she first immersed herself in the Okoyong language while she was back with the Efik people until she was fluent with the language. But the mission council would not agree to let her go to the Oboyong people. For more than a year, Mary begged the mission council to accept her request to go alone farther upriver. For even a man to go upriver to the Okoyong tribe was a bold and daring idea, and the mission council, as well as the colonial governor, steadfastly refused, considering her request reckless. But finally, after a year of ceaseless prayer, the mission council and the governor acquiesced to Mary's request. Older workers and soldiers who had visited the Okoyong territory described them as a wretched and wicked Sodom, where all the superstitions and barbarous customs of paganism, including cannibalism, are practiced. Belief in demons was universal. Witchcraft was practiced everywhere, and human sacrifices were offered frequently on the river's edge for success in fishing. Whenever twin children were born, they were taken from their mothers and immediately buried alive or left in the woods to be devoured by wild animals. The mothers of twins were believed to have conceived with the help of evil spirits. So they were often murdered or driven from the village to die of starvation in the forest if they weren't killed by wild animals. If a chief or a great man died, his wives would be buried alive with him, his slaves beheaded, and their heads thrown into the chief's grave. To these terrible customs were added incessant warfare with other tribes, taking prisoners to serve as slaves or be cannibalized. On August 3, 1883, Mary Slessor completed her preparations. A drizzling rain fell on her fellow workers as they sadly accompanied her to what they were sure was her death. They bade her farewell as Efik tribesmen rowed her canoe upriver. The tribesmen were terrified but trusted in Mary and her unshakable faith in God to protect them. Upon their arrival, Mary begged the surprised chief for permission to establish a mission compound in his village. He might have been considering how tasty she might become. But providentially, the chief's sister took an instant liking to the bold Scottish foreigner with red hair, so fluently spoke their language. She induced her brother to let Mary build a compound next to the village. The next day, Mary began supervising the construction of a modest mission compound that would include a central mud-walled house she would live in and several smaller buildings for supplies and the women and children she was quietly planning to rescue. The rainy season had set in, so the building site was soon a pool of mud, but Mary would not be discouraged. With bare feet and her hair cut short like the Okoyong women, she worked day after day with the workers she had hired, subsisting on native food, drinking unfiltered water, getting drenched with rain, and doing everything that would have killed an ordinary woman. The barbarism Mary encountered was appalling. Headhunting was one of their favorite pursuits, and between fights, the men were given to drunkenness and bloody brawls. The natives took to her at once because she spoke their language and because she was fearless. Not long after her arrival, twins were born in the village. Mary immediately fought to keep them. Her fearlessness, her good humor, and her pleas were irresistible and saved the twin babies and their mother. On another day, when the village men got into a deadly fight, Mary got in between them. When they threatened her, she threatened them in turn. When they laughed, she laughed with them. At times, she would scold them like boys. Other times, she would weep until they were ashamed. When they wouldn't obey, she turned her back on them. But always, she kept her fearless, commanding attitude, knowing that the Lord Jesus was with her, winning both their awe and their respect. Mary's love for God and for the people made her amazingly bold. As months stretched into years among the Okoyong, Mary succeeded in saving countless mothers and twins. She daily searched the woods to find them, brought them into her compound, fed them, and loved them. Though this violated every tribal custom, no one dared interfere with her. The mothers and children she saved, she led to faith in Christ and discipled. It did not take long for her compound to be filled, but Mary's stubborn personality, her love for the people, and her unshakable faith in God's power and protection eventually subdued the Okoyong people to her will. Once she rescued a baby girl who had been alone and exposed in the bush for almost 5 days. She was dehydrated, starving, covered with insect bites and sores, and barely alive. With infinite patience, Mary nursed the little girl back to health. Many years later, and after finishing school, the girl married an educated Nigerian in the service of the government. She never forgot Mary's kindness and remained a true Christian. Another time, the tribal chief's son was killed when a tree fell on him. The village witch doctor urged the chief to attack another tribe's village and bring the prisoners to be slaughtered as a sacrifice to the spirits. With incredible boldness, Mary stepped between the armies, and with her persistent pleas and commands, saved all of the victims and freed them. In the end, she convinced the chief to sacrifice a cow instead of the village that they had captured. It was the first Okuyung royal grave not saturated in human blood. In 1891, the British government appointed Mary vice consul for the Okuyung region and gave her complete freedom to preach the gospel. Though she did not like the routine work connected with the position, she accepted it because it gave her increased authority and prestige to stop murders, slavery, and tribal wars. In 1894, she wrote in her report, "No tribe was formerly so feared because of their utter disregard of human life than the Okuyung. Human life is now safe among the Okuyung. Previously, no chief ever died without the sacrifice of many human lives, but this custom has now ceased. Some chiefs, in commenting on the wonderful change, have said, 'Ma, your God is mighty. No other power could have done this.'" Even though she became the vice consul for the Okuyung, Mary Slessor never forgot the one great task that had brought her to Africa. She always talked about the good news of Jesus. In 1915, at the age of 67, Mary Slessor died of malaria, surrounded by the grateful people she had loved to faith in Jesus. How did Mary do it? The same way Hudson Taylor did it. One, she lived by faith and loved God. Two, she left her home and family in Scotland, moved to Southeast Nigeria, and learned the people's languages and culture. Three, regardless of the dangers, she faithfully proclaimed the good news of Jesus to the people God sent her to. Four, she considered her life less important than the lives of the people she loved. And fifth, she never stopped making disciples and teaching them to obey the commands of Jesus, including his last command. One last story. Carl was born in Pennsylvania, the son of Swedish immigrants. He came to faith in Christ at the age of 16. When he was four, his father was working in the coal mines, a job he hated. He began drinking, and one night, after staying too long in the bar, he ran over a little girl on his way home. A few days later, he hanged himself. It was the Great Depression, and Carl's mother remarried quickly to keep food on the table for her husband and two sons. Carl's new father hated the church and called pastors leeches who didn't work for a living. His new father was an alcoholic and a harsh disciplinarian. More than once, Carl's stepfather beat him until his back was bloody. After several beatings like that, Carl's mother began defending him, her two children, with her fists in a frying pan. The fights in Carl's home became unbearable. One day, Carl's mother went into town and heard singing coming from the open doors of a church. She went in and listened as the pastor preached the gospel. That day, her battered soul found Jesus. When she returned home, the whole family noticed a difference. The next Sunday, Carl went to church with his mother and gave his life to Jesus. And when he returned home, he told his father. His father became so angry that he got the shotgun down from the mantle, pointed it at Carl, and told him to never come back. Carl was just 16 and had nowhere to go, but a Christian widow took him in and the church helped him with food and clothing. His mother saw him at church every Sunday and encouraged him in his faith. One day, a pastor came to the church and told how God had called him to go to a country where nobody had ever heard of Jesus. As Carl listened to the story of how people came to faith in Christ and how their lives were transformed, a light came on in his heart, and he suddenly heard God calling him to become that kind of a pastor. After high school, he went to Bible school, and while he was there, he met a beautiful girl named Ruth. She had grown up in Vietnam, the child of an American pastor and his wife who had preached the gospel in that land. Carl and Ruth married, and in 1949, the church sent them to eastern Cambodia to preach the gospel to devout Buddhists who had never heard of God. After 10 years, Carl and Ruth had established a small church of about 50 Cambodian Christians near the city of Krache. You can see underlined on that slide, on that map, Krache. Well, it used to have a line under it. It's by the D in Cambodia. Then one day, a group of chiefs from a tribe that lived near the border between Vietnam and Cambodia came to Carl and Ruth's house. They wore loincloths and used homemade crossbows to hunt animals. They had walked 100 miles to ask Carl to come to their village and tell them the story of the God who made the world. For centuries, their ancestors had passed down the story how God made the world, how the first humans listened to an evil snake and became so wicked that God sent a flood to destroy the world. The only survivors were a man and his family who had built a huge boat and filled it with animals. That was all they knew of the story. And though they worshiped the spirits, they wanted to hear the rest of the story. They told Carl they were called the Benong people and that they were a big tribe living in many villages to the east of Cambodia, in the eastern part. The roads to the border area where the Benong lived in their villages were barely passable, but Carl and Ruth agreed to come. Over the next 10 years, they learned the Benong language and customs and visited their villages. At each village, they would tell the people the story of God from the beginning and continue to the coming of God's Son, Jesus. While there were logging roads, Carl and Ruth drove their truck to the villages, but where there weren't any roads, the Benong chiefs met them with elephants to ride on. Carl and Ruth visited more than 40 Benong villages, and in each village they would stay for several days and tell the story. Every night the people would gather around a big fire in the center of the village and listen to the story of God and his son Jesus. But again and again, the people would tell them they were not ready to follow Jesus. They were too afraid of the spirits that they worshiped and they sacrificed to. Carl and Ruth became quite discouraged after 10 years, but they were not ready to give up. Then in 1965, Cambodia's king ordered all Americans to leave Cambodia. North Vietnam had moved its army into eastern Cambodia as part of its effort to conquer South Vietnam, making it too dangerous for Carl and Ruth to visit the Benong villages. Because none of the Benong had become Christians, Carl and Ruth were heartbroken as they left Cambodia. But there were Benong villages on the Vietnam side of the border. So Carl and Ruth moved to South Vietnam, learned the Vietnamese language. Then they moved to a city that was close to the Benong villages. They were happy to find a handful of Benong believers there and began to disciple them. But a few months later, in January 1968, the North Vietnamese army attacked the cities all over Vietnam, including the city where Carl and Ruth were living with other workers. It was January 29th, 1968, the Chinese New Year. During the night, North Vietnamese soldiers blew up the house next to Carl and Ruth's house, killing two of their colleagues. Carl, Ruth, and four other workers took refuge in a deep ditch behind their houses as the fighting went on. The next day, all of the workers' houses were destroyed, and the North Vietnamese army overran half the city. Finally, Carl, Ruth, and the other workers tried to surrender under a white flag. But as soon as the soldiers saw them, they killed them with machine gun fire and a hand grenade. American and South Vietnamese soldiers eventually drove the communist soldiers out of that city. They found the bodies of Carl, Ruth, and an American nurse who died with them, and they buried them together where they fell. It was a very sad day. It looked like the Benong people would be forgotten. But the war was far from over and would continue for another 7 years. In 1975, 7 years later, the North Vietnamese army tried again to conquer South Vietnam. And as you know, this time they succeeded. But first they drove their tanks and marched their army into eastern Cambodia, burning all of the villages of the tribal peoples there, including the Benong people, and all of their rice fields, so they had to leave. They drove them across the border into South Vietnam. The people could flee with only what they could carry on their backs. There were no roads, they had no vehicles. And so they quickly ran out of food. Many of them got sick. The South Vietnamese government put those who survived that exodus in abandoned American bases, but they had no warm clothes, no food, and no medicines for those who were sick. But then an amazing thing happened. Vietnamese and American Christians who were still in Vietnam, despite the war, brought the tribal refugees food, water, medicines, and the gospel. When the Benong heard the gospel, their leader stood up and said, "Hey, we've heard this story before. From our American friend, Carl, and his wife, they came to our village and they told us this story. Where are they? Why aren't they here too?" Well, those who were there said, when Carl and Ruth left Cambodia, they came here. And they began telling your friends, other Benong villages on this side of the border, about Jesus. And some of them came to faith in Jesus. But less than 2 years later, the North Vietnamese army attacked the city and killed them as they tried to surrender. They're buried now, not far from here, up over that mountain. You can see their graves. When the Benong heard that Carl and Ruth had been killed, trying to bring the gospel to their people, they cried and they wept. Something broke in their hearts. And in the months that followed, they began to turn to Jesus. First 100, then 500, then 1,000. A year later, the North Vietnamese Communist Army took over the country. But by then, 6,000 Benong had become Christians and believed in Jesus. They had been baptized and they were following him. As soon as they could, the Benong went back across the border, back to their lands and their villages in Cambodia. They took the gospel with them and they shared it with all of their friends. That was 48 years ago. Recently, I learned that today, there are more than 107,000 Benong Christians in Cambodia and Vietnam. Carl and Ruth were my mother and father. And that's how God won the hearts of the Benong people. This was my family several years before my parents were killed. Like Hudson Taylor and Mary Slessor, Carl and Ruth Thompson lived by faith and loved God. They left their home and family in America, lived in Cambodia and Vietnam, and learned the languages and cultures of the Cambodians and the Benong people. Regardless of the dangers to their own lives, they faithfully proclaimed the good news to the people God sent them to. They considered their lives less important than the lives of the people God sent them to save. They never stopped making disciples and teaching them to obey the commands of Jesus, including his last command. Perhaps by now you have noticed that in all three of these stories, God's servants followed the example of Jesus. He left his home in heaven. He came to earth in a human body as a baby. He learned the people's languages and cultures. He gave up his life for those he came to save. He never stopped teaching his disciples to believe in him and obey all his commands. How can we follow their examples? It depends. What if Westside Church of Reading set a goal to send just one of its members, at the most two, to take the gospel to just one of the 7,272 unreached people groups in the world? That would leave 7,271 for other churches to reach. But it's not enough to say, well, that's great, I like this idea. Let me give you four necessary faithful steps to take on such a challenge. One, someone has to go. Not in the sense of leaving or we're going to kick them out. Someone has to go to an unreached people group. Just as Jesus came to earth to save the world, someone has to go to where people don't know Christ and are waiting to hear. We can call ourselves a supporting church today because we support international workers, and that's a wonderful thing, and I hope we continue to do that generously. But when someone from our own church body gets up and goes to reach an unreached people group, we're supporting our own version of Hudson Taylor, of Mary Slessor, of Carl and Ruth. Because they went today, there are hundreds of millions of Christians in far-off places all over the earth. Just three people. If God were to call you and you're looking at yourself like I did and saying, no way. Don't forget the Apostle Paul was a middle-aged enemy of the church when Jesus called him. Peter, James, and John started as fishermen and sounds like it, they weren't so great at it either. Mary Magdalene was probably in her 40s when Jesus called her. Mary's mother had to be in her 60s when she followed Jesus and the disciples around and helped them on their mission. On the other end of the age spectrum, Timothy was a teenager when God called him. My father, Carl, who went by Ed, was just 16 when God called him. Becky and I were 13. How about those of you who are middle-aged or recently retired? You may be considering a nice cruise somewhere, and there's nothing wrong with going on a nice cruise. I hope to do that someday. But have you ever considered going to another country in the world instead, not as a tourist, but for lost people, in an economy seat of a jet plane? For 2 weeks or a month, you could do much to help an international worker accomplish an important project that you are skilled at. Or you could encourage an international worker in other ways, like taking over some of their responsibilities for a week or two so they can take a vacation. If God enabled you financially, would you consider going multiple times to one place where God is at work and the needs are great? To help, to encourage, to bless more than once. Your grown children will marvel, and so will your grandchildren. Not only that, but your example could be the seed of something wonderful in your children's and your grandchildren's lives, including their lives in eternity. Two decades ago, a gastroenterologist in his early 60s from a church we spoke at in Ohio came up to me afterwards and said, "What could I do to help?" And I said, "Well, we have a hospital in the jungles of Gabon. I'm training surgery residents, and I have no way of training them to do endoscopy when people come in vomiting blood or other gory things like that. And so if you could come and teach them, you know, bring some used equipment and teach my residents how to do endoscopy, it would be a huge blessing to the patients that come and that we witness to, and they'll take that skill with them to all these other countries in Africa." And so he was a bit taken aback, but once he talked it over with his wife and his partners and prayed about it, he got on a plane and he came. For 2 weeks, he worked with all five of my surgery residents, shared his testimony with them, heard theirs. He also taught one of our nurses how to clean the equipment and be an assistant. It was a great start for my residents, because except in the textbooks, they'd never even seen an endoscope. So he was so blessed that the next year he came back again, this time with his wife, and brought more endoscopy equipment, staying just 2 weeks at a time, but returning every year. He kept coming back. He greatly improved the residents' endoscopy skills. His wife spent time with the residents' wives and taught them how to use a simple sewing machine. Since then, this couple has come short-term to Bungalow Hospital every year for 15 years. They have had a huge impact. Their example amazed our African staff and impacted the faith of at least 20 of our residents and their families. Our residents are now serving in 12 different countries in Africa with the skills that he taught them. So think twice before you say, "Well, you know, I'm middle-aged, I couldn't do anything." What skills — they didn't even have to learn language to do that — what skills might some of you have here today, not necessarily medical, that could hold up the arms of weary workers overseas? If your faith measures up to the challenge, and that's really the question, scrap the cruise. Let God use you in kingdom ways. So, in review, number one, someone has to go. Secondly, more someones have to send. What does sending mean? It's not the same thing as financial support. Sending is helping people who agree or hear God's call to be international workers, helping them to meet all the requirements of the sending organization, helping them to purchase ministry tools and what they don't already have, helping to pack and ship their belongings, helping them to manage their property that they leave behind, helping them to arrange to help older children who are college age or needing a home away from home, helping them to communicate regularly with supporters with news updates, prayer requests, ongoing needs, doing everything possible to help future international workers focus on reaching the people God is calling them to without money, without financial giving to them. Most of us who are older have grandchildren. So that's one way. But here's another. Most of us who are older have grandchildren. Have you ever read your grandchild a missionary story? Here's one. I wrote it with on purpose to be something that children would understand and enjoy. Have you ever taken them to see a missionary film? More than once? Have you suggested to your grandchildren that God could use them in mighty and marvelous ways to move unreached people groups from eternity in hell to eternity in heaven? You who are parents of children in our church have even greater influence. Are you willing to suggest to your children that they consider to follow God's call to take the gospel to unreached people? I hear parents talking about their kids going to law school, business, engineering, all kinds of 100 other professions, but I almost never hear Christian parents talking about encouraging their children, whatever profession they go into, to find a way to take the gospel to the world, to be beautiful feet to people who have never heard. In addition, are you willing to pray that God would call your children, your grandchildren, to serve long-term as international workers? Praying changes people's minds, you know, including children. If they show interest, are you willing to encourage them? Oh, and send my baby grandkids that they have away too? It's hard. But someone has to go, and more someones have to send. Three, many someones have to give. Some of you may not know that 10% of the offerings that we give in our church goes to missions and supports international workers. So every time you put an offering in the box at the back, you are giving a tenth of it to missions. So please, give generously, give often. If we give generously enough, then even members who don't have the resources to travel, members from our church, to an international worker's field of labor could benefit from our giving. They could go on a short-term mission trip, spend a month there or 2 weeks or whatever, doing something that would really advance the work of that international worker. So if one of our church, member of our church, hears God's call and is willing to go, the home church must be especially generous, even if they find much of their support in other churches. So someone has to go, more someones have to send, many someones have to give, and the final one, many someones must pray. Not just as we fall asleep at night or when we're gathered here, but every day for what we and the ones we send want to happen in their ministries. In my experience, 5% of my efforts as an international worker produce the desired results. If we want them to succeed, the other 95% must come from God. And that's where it comes from. It comes from God. How do we convince God to act on their behalf? By praying. That's God's way. That's God's plan. We can send tons of money, but if we're not praying, they're not going to succeed. It's as simple as that. E.M. Bounds, the great theologian of prayer, wrote, "When God declares the eyes of the Lord run to and fro throughout the whole earth to show himself strong on behalf of them whose heart is perfect toward him, he declares the necessity of men and women to depend on God as the channel through which he will exert his power upon the world." God's power upon the world is exerted when you and I pray for the workers we send out and we support. The prayers of God's saints are the capital stock in heaven by which Christ carries on his great work upon the earth. By prayers, the earth is changed, revolutionized. Angels move on more powerfully or on more rapid wings, and God's policy is shaped as our prayers are more numerous and more efficient. It is true that the mightiest successes that come to God's cause are created and carried on by prayer. When was the last time that you prayed for 5 minutes every morning for a missionary? To the degree that we pray, the international workers we support and send will have success in their work. Becky and I had many faithful prayer warriors supporting our work. I just am amazed to this day. And for that, they will receive a great reward. Several years after we arrived in Gabon, one of the prayer requests that I posted to our praying friends is that we needed $1 million for God to build a bridge across the 75-foot-wide river that separated our hospital from the town of Libamba. Only $1 million. People laughed, but we prayed, and our supporters prayed for a long time, I will admit, 17 years. During those 17 years, every car, truck, or ambulance had to cross the river on a hand-pulled ferry that our team was responsible to maintain. I even learned how to weld, terribly, but I did. More times than I care to remember, people who were dying came at night when there was nobody there to cross the ferry. After 17 years of that, U.S., Canadian, and Gabonese governments collaborated to build a $1 million bridge in 1994. Nothing is impossible for those who pray, especially those who pray continually and in faith. So friends, let's do this. Let's do this. Let's challenge someone in our midst, in our body, to go to one of the 7,000 plus unreached people groups that are waiting in darkness. Jesus isn't going to come until the church does all this. And then let's send, let's give, and let's pray. And together, in partnership with God, let's bring one unreached people group, for starters, into the kingdom. And God will call our feet and all who engage in this great enterprise beautiful. Let's pray.